This is the fifth and final instalment of a five-part interview with Cory Doctorow, conducted by Rachel Baker and Charles Beckett of Arts Council England. Doctorow discusses the bursting of the dot-com bubble in the late 1990s, his forthcoming novel Makers, and, rather generously, gives his advice to cultural funding bodies.
Yeah, so I set out actually to write a parable about the dot-com crash, which was I lived through in San Francisco, which was an interesting place to ride out the dot-com crash. And what happened in San Francisco, and to a larger extent everywhere, is that the dot-com bubble transferred an enormous amount of money from pension funds and other institutional investors through venture capitalists into humanities majors and taught them how to do HTML, Perl, and basic web stuff. And then all the money went away. And so what you were left with were thousands and thousands and thousands of kind of creative people who now had the technical capability and access to the tools to make kind of anything they could think of. Although there was no economic model for it, there was also no cost to doing it. And so they just made stuff. And so I wrote a book about a world in which the economy collapses and people go on to make stuff, physical stuff. They make using 3D printers and other and open source software and open hardware. They just invent stuff like crazy, and they're funded by something that looks a lot like the Grameen Bank. It's a group of investment bankers who take over some big old dinosauric companies. And in my world, it's Duracell and Kodak, and they call it Kodacell. They take these two firms and they break them up for parts, take their assets, turn it into cash, and then invest it in $10,000 increments in little tech startups. Three people in a dead mall make something, and then 4 weeks later it'll be copied by the Chinese and you need to make something else. And that's your entire run for it, kind of like pop-up shops. And the market becomes enormously successful. 20% of the American workforce relocates to rural parts of America where they can build these workshops for nothing in dead exurbs. And then it collapses because the market doesn't know how to value it. They're of course cooking the books with derivatives, and they keep making stuff. Even though the economy around it has collapsed, they just keep making stuff. And they run up against trademark holders, copyright holders. In fact, it's somewhat inspired by the BPI, because the spokesman for the BPI a couple of years ago gave a talk where he said, he was talking to a mixed group of people from different industries, and he said, you know, you people, you think the record industry is all screwed up because we sue our customers. You just wait. When 3D printers come along, every business that relies on trademarks or patents, you're all going to be where we are, and you're going to be just as hysterical as we are. And I look back on that. A friend of mine said, wow, that's kind of visionary. You've got like a guy from the record industry talking about 3D printers. And I said, yeah, but he thinks the major problem that's going to arise from a 3D printer is trademark infringement. Like, what about people who print AK-47s, right? I mean, this is like saying the major impact of the railroad is going to be that's going to put everyone who makes oat bags for horses out of work. I mean, it's undoubtedly true, but to call it the most significant impact of the railroad is to entirely miss the point of railroads. So, I the second half of the book, the second act, is all about what happens when people who think that trademark infringement is the most important thing about 3D printing get in on the game, and it kind of goes from there. It's a nice long epic book. It's kind of the longest book and also the longest time scale of any book I've written. And I'm really happy with how it came out, and it's very fortuitous that the economy collapsed just in time for its publication. So,
yeah, about that. Because there was a point where it felt like there was a sort of renewed dot-com euphoria happening before the banks ruined it for everybody. And I went to South by Southwest last March, and there was still a lot of optimism around. I wondered if you had any thoughts about that period of, you know, the dot-com boom and bust, and what's happening now, and what the kind of comparisons and contrasts are. The sort of businesses that people are now, the ventures that people are now looking to build up, seem to be slightly different from the ones that people were experimenting with in the late 90s.
Well, I think it gets back to this notion of impedance matching. The people who have the investment capital and the experience and the connections to kind of churn up a big market around a technology tend to have their heads rooted in the way that firms are organized in the old way, right? So they tend to be more old-fashioned in their vision of what a firm is. It looks very grown up. It's got org charts. It's got C-level executives. It's got a glass hallway where they sit. It's got a bunch of stuff that's very that looks very grown up and adult, and fundamentally hasn't changed much since, you know, more or less the advent of scientific management, Taylorism, and so on. They really look like what they look like, what you know, Yahoo looks like today. And even to a lesser extent, Google looks like today, although Google is organized pretty differently from its competitors. And with each subsequent boom and bust cycle, those people who really want their to take $20 million and put it into a company that grows to 3,000 employees and turns it to $200 million, there are fewer of those people every time around, but there's still a bunch of them. And it's not like it's impossible. It's absolutely possible, Yahoo being a great example of it. It's just not very sustainable, Yahoo being a great example of it. It kind of, you end up with something that is where its function follows its form, that has all the inefficiencies, all the problems, all the lack of vision, all the difficulties of the last generation of enterprises that predate this new kind of technological revolution. So the countervailing force to that are people who are like, small is beautiful. We can individually maybe not walk away with this jackpot of $1 billion, multi-billion dollar jackpot like the Google founders have. But what we can probably do is earn a very, very good living and maybe even have something saleable when we're ready to retire, or even bring in some capital on it, where we can provide an annuity to someone from it and get some capital and grow a little. But we don't need to, nor can we grow to that scale. There's just no future in it for us. And those are the two countervailing forces. And the people who want to be small, and the people who want those enterprises to be big, so that they can turn a pension fund, $20 million of a pension fund, into $200 million of a pension fund. Those are forever in tension. The old side is weakening. It was buoyed up somewhat during the cheap money bubble, which is what we just lived through, where essentially through exotic debt instruments, it was possible to make money out of thin air. And then that money had to go to work. And so everything became much more capitalized. Everything that could be capitalized was capitalized beyond its ability to even spend it. So you had enormous amounts of capital pouring into the studios and the rise of $3 million movies, a lot of startups being funded to crazy sums. You had even things like you know, the ICM and other management firms having lots of money come into them, and then themselves playing some kind of venture capital role where they were approaching people and trying to spend on them. That was what one of the knock-on factors of the cheap money bubble. It'd be a mistake to think of that as kind of intrinsic to dot-coms. That happened everywhere.
I have a final question. Mm-hmm. I know we're running out of time. What, Corey, would your advice be to cultural funding bodies like the Arts Council in relation to this sort of new phase that may be coming about through digital culture and the challenges it presents to the arts?
So I would say that I have a strategic vision and two tactical mechanisms for accomplishing it. The strategic vision is to promulgate, nurture, promote, and preserve the British culture that is endemic to Britain. It's the multicultural matrix of aesthetics, humor, narratives, and so on that are what makes Britain Britain, and ties the country together, the story it tells itself. The two tactical mechanisms by which I'd accomplish that is, first, to see that British culture becomes part of the lingua franca, first in Britain, and secondly, outside of Britain, because Britain is not an island. Of course, Britain is an island, but Britain is not a cultural island, in that it imports an enormous amount of culture. And importing that culture, to the extent that culture is inflected with British culture, either explicitly, like when an artist samples a British artist and puts a recognizable British tune into, say, a Bollywood song, That's one way of doing it. The other one is when you have things like American comedians who grew up watching Monty Python, and you have comedy that's recognizably descended from Monty Python, kind of echoing back. That's one, and I think the way that you do that is by making sure that the media is open, so that it competes in this global marketplace, both domestically and abroad, with all the other media for the choices that artists and creators have when they mix and remix, and if the stuff that Britain has is actively available to them, not just open licensed, although that's obviously step one. Step two is viral, right? Actually, like put in the way of people who are thinking about making new media, so that it's always there, always to hand. You know, if you had media levies, for example, in Britain, if the media levy included a requirement that people who sell media preload it with free British media that had been paid for with public money, so that every time you got some media, it was filled with you know, some blank media, CD or a DVD or some magnetic media or whatever, it was filled with British culture, and that stuff was just always available everywhere you went. There was just tons of this stuff lying around waiting to be mixed and curated and so on. So and also abroad, so that either Britons or foreigners, when they're sitting down to make media, choose stuff that continues Britain's narrative. And then the other piece of this is very complementary to it, which is to ensure that Britons themselves are among the most talented remixers in the world, in the way that Brazilians, for example, are now known for being, such that even when media that originates outside of Britain and isn't very British in its outlook gets to Britain, sure, the first thing that happens to it is it's remixed in a million uniquely British ways, so that it becomes the kernel of a very British form of expression, in the same way that this African carved Coke bottle is distinctively African, even though it was invented in Atlanta. If British people, like Brazilians today, were among the world's best and most prolific and most talented remixers, then it would mean that even when narratives that were not British came to Britain, they would be immediately mixed and remixed and made British again, the same way that this Coke bottle that's been carved out of a dark tropical wood by an African carver is distinctively African, even though it was originally designed in Atlanta. This has been effectively Africanized, and you could Britishize everything that came here. Now, having a lot of remixable media makes people accustomed to mixing. And having a digital environment in which those mixes can flow also makes people accustomed to remixing, because it allows the inspiration to flow from one mixer to another. I hear your mix, it inspires my mix. My mix can be heard by someone else, and so on. So my advice to a funder would be to ensure that everything that you fund is strategically aligned with those objectives, so that it's open. It doesn't have GOIP borders, so you don't have people who are trying to do territorial stuff with it. It has some kind of aesthetic or ethos that actively encourages this kind of thing, and really is part of a public spending strategy that's built on making Britain's stories powerful and vibrant, and keeping them alive in Britain.
Do you have an exemplar in your mind of this remix, remix vision that you have?
Well, I have a lot of good counterexamples, right? The National Portrait Gallery is a great example. So here's tons of public money being spent on exhibitions, including exhibitions of things like the pop artists. A couple of years ago, I went and saw an Andy Warhol exhibition at the Portrait Gallery. It was Warhol, Rauschenberg, and Poons, who are like massive infringers, right? Their whole thing was remixing. Portrait Gallery not only doesn't let you take pictures of the portraits, which is crazy enough because it's public money. Why can't you take a memory of that home? It doesn't let you take pictures of the signs that say no photography allowed, because the staff have been trained to say that the signs are copyrighted, that the typography on the signs are copyrighted. So if you're a burgeoning portraitist, or if you somehow want to take that and bring it home and Britishize it and kind of mix it and make it part of your story, that public spending is completely off limits to you. A counterexample would maybe be something like something my wife is always kicking around for Channel 4. She's Commissioner of Education there. And she's been talking about commissioning high resolution levels based on the Great British Museum's for video games, for like Counter-Strike or any other kind of first-person shooter game, with all of the public domain art and any licensable art reproduced at high resolution, so that as you play in these worlds for hundreds of hours, as you do, the actual map of the museum becomes as well known to you as the high street in your village. And any time you actually go to it, it's got the familiarity of a place that you've visited 1,000 times. And moreover, all of the art in the museum becomes part of your visual vernacular. It becomes part of something that you are just familiar with at a cellular level, not because someone sat you down with an art history textbook, but because you've lived it. And you know, if we could come up with a 100 strategies like this, where we were spending public money to make the public more in touch with the culture that the public money was there to sustain, I think that it would be a tremendously good story about how to, how and why we should continue to fund the arts in this country.